From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1969, at the height of the country's anguish over the Vietnam War, just over half of Americans said that war was a mistake, and the streets and campuses and airwaves were full of wild protest. Now, in January 2007, two-thirds of Americans say they oppose the Iraq War. But the opposition has a different feel this time. Merle Haggard and Pearl Jam and Eminem and Neil Young are singing Get Out of Iraq. There have been and will be more marches and protests. Cindy Sheehan camped out in Crawford. But the anti-war movement this time has new terrain, too. Hugely on the web and deliberately deep in, not out, of mainstream politics. Up next on Point, the Iraq War and the anti-war movement this time. Joining me now from Washington is a panel of three leaders and watchers. I'm joined from Washington by Tom Andrews. He's the National Director of Win Without War. It's a coalition of more than 40 organizations, including Move On, the NAACP, and the National Council of Churches. He's a former two-term congressman from Maine. Tom Andrews, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Also with us from Washington, we're joined by Nancy Lesson, co-founder of Military Families Speak Out. It's an organization of more than 3,000 families with loved ones serving in the military who are opposed to the war in Iraq. Her stepson, U.S. Marine Sergeant Joe Richardson, served 8 years and was deployed in Iraq in the spring of 2003. Nancy Lesson, thank you for joining us today.
It's great to be here, Tom.
And we're joined by Michael Kazin. He's professor of history at Georgetown University, author of The Populist Persuasion in American History, and a leading scholar on American social movements. Professor Kazin, thanks for joining us.
Yes.
Great to have you. Thanks for being here. Tom Andrews, let me turn first to you, if I may. Give us a snapshot right now. It has not overwhelmed the culture as it did in the Vietnam War era, but we know that you and many like you are out there. Give us a snapshot of your work in the anti-war movement. Where are you right now? What's going on?
Well, Tom, I think this is an extremely important moment for the anti-war movement and certainly for the country and for the Middle East region. First of all, what you've got is a combination of, I think, three important factors here. Number one, the anti-war movement was very, very much involved in the congressional elections. Time, energy, resources went into those elections, and we elected a Democratic Congress, and we did so with the Iraq issue so prominently part of that election, specifically for the purpose of having the Democrats in Congress stand up and stop the president from this, certainly from escalating the war, but our intention was to stop this war. Secondly, there's the extraordinary deterioration of conditions in Iraq that we all know about. Daily headlines, things are getting bad, they're getting worse, and so people are fully aware that the president's plan for Iraq has been a complete failure. And then finally, the salt on the wound was the president's announced escalation of the war last week, when he defied not only the majority of the American people, military generals that advised him against this, the Iraq Study Group, and certainly public opinion, broad public opinion across the country, by escalating the war as opposed to doing what the Iraq Study Group had recommended. The combination of these three factors have people enraged. And we said, look, 24 hours after the president makes that speech, hit the streets. Go to your neighborhood town square. Go to your church, your synagogue, your mosque, and express your opinion. And we did that with 48 hours. And in that 48-hour time period, more than 1,000 events occurred, tens of thousands of people in all 50 states. And it's because we are in this moment in time. People are angry, and they're ready to be active.
Nancy Lesson, you're with the Military Families Speak Out. How's your membership feeling right now, and what does your anti-war movement constitute? What is the work that you do?
Well, we began with two military families speaking out in 2002 in the fall to try to prevent a U.S. invasion of Iraq. We are now over 3,200 military families speaking out to end the U.S. military occupation of Iraq, bring our troops home now, and take care of them when they get here. Our focus at this moment is really on Congress. Since the president's speech last Wednesday, we've had 60 new military families join the organization to speak out to bring this to an end. And we think the focus right now has to be on Congress and getting them to use their power of the purse to cut off all funds for continuing and escalating the war. We really believe that the most supportive thing that can happen right now is for them to defund the war. And in fact, they're going to have a funding bill come before them. And too many of them are saying, oh, we must support the troops, so we have to give them the funds. We can't abandon them. What we're saying is, if you fund this war, you are in fact abandoning our troops. And if you fund this war, it will be your war. It's not going to be George Bush's war. You will have bought it and you will own it. We don't want to go there. We are using all means right now to communicate with Congress, and that means meeting with them. It means setting up protests outside their offices and sometimes outside their homes, displaying boots of fallen service members to call attention to the ongoing toll of the war. Each day that this war continues, two, three, four or more of our loved ones, our troops are being killed, and countless Iraqi children, women, and men. So there is an urgency here, and there is an opportunity to bring it to an end. And we are mobilizing across the country to do just that.
Tom Andrews, describe for us how you see the importance of the anti-war movement in this war. You've got very widespread opposition to Iraq. It's in the polls looking something like 67% in the latest CNN poll that I saw. When that much of the public is against the war, what's the point, the purpose, the leading edge of the anti-war movement? Do you see it as a movement separate from the rest of the populace? What's the, you know, what's the point is the wrong question, but do you see what I'm driving at? When so many are against it, does the anti-war movement matter?
Well, yes, the anti-war movement matters. And that population, the American public, is now part of that anti-war movement. Those numbers that you've just cited are very, very clear indications of where the public is. And, of course, members of Congress are going to face very stiff opposition to what the vast majority of Americans want by this administration. And they're going to do everything that they possibly can to intimidate members of Congress not to stand up. And as Nancy has just said, begin the process of cutting off funds to continue this war. So what you need to have, I mean, there's the old political maxim, a politician may not always be able to see the light, but they will always be able to feel the heat. And what we have to do is mobilize not only those who have been traditionally involved in this movement that have been so active in the elections, but now expand that to give opportunities to everyone out there to make their voices heard. And as Nancy said, the key to that is communicating with members of Congress and letting them know that it is important for them not only to take positions, public positions against the war and against the escalation, but to actually do something about it. Right now, of course, the leadership is saying that they're going to have a non-binding resolution on Iraq. Well, listen, the president of the United States has bound this country into a disaster in Iraq. He has bound our young men and women in uniform to a nightmare in Iraq. It demands of a Congress elected on the basis of this election to take not non-binding actions, but to take real actions. And the Constitution provides a system of checks and balances by providing the Congress of the United States with the power of the purse. Nancy Lessen is exactly right. And the focus needs to be translating that broad public support, as you've cited. There's 12% of the public, you know, supports this escalation proposal by the president, and direct that into action to make sure that Congress does the right thing. Mm.
Michael Kazin, we feel the energy right there, right now. You've followed American social movements and anti-war protest over time. How do you see it this time? How is it like and unlike the Vietnam war anti-war protests that so dominate our cultural memory?
Well, it's like it in the sense that there's a real moralistic and moral appeal to get the troops out, to stop the bloodletting, to let people in Iraq run their own country. But it's unlike it in some ways, which I think actually are very favorable to this anti-war movement, in the sense that, first of all, it's more pragmatic. The whole idea of cutting off the funds really didn't become an important part of the Vietnam anti-war movement until 1973. Congress didn't put a lot of pressure on the president to cut off funds until that point.
It didn't really happen until the troops were out.
Well, pretty much, yeah. That was 8 years after the U.S. had taken over the brunt of the fighting in South Vietnam. Also, I think because this is George Bush's war, George Bush, a conservative Republican, the protest has been much more oriented towards getting Democrats elected, especially in 2004 and 2006. And in the Vietnam era, the war was seen as a liberal war. It was being prosecuted first by John Kennedy and then by Lyndon Johnson, and therefore the protest against it was further to the left. It was run really by radicals, by anti-imperialists, by people who were opposed to constituted authority, as it were. And now it's quite different. Now it's much more, if you will, within the system.
Mm-hmm. We're hearing this hour from and looking at the anti-war movement, this time against the war in Iraq. I'm joined by Tom Andrews, National Director of Win Without War, Nancy Lesson. She's co-founder of Military Families Speak Out. Michael Kazin's here as well. He's a professor of history at Georgetown, focused a lot on U.S. social movements. We've got one going on right now. Since the start of the war, protesters have argued that supporting withdrawal was patriotic and stepping out to protest democratic.
Let no one deny that we are patriots. We support our nation's troops. Let's hear it for our nation's troops.
And I'm a veteran, that's right. And like, what are they saying? They've never seen Iraq. They don't know what's going on. 655,000 civilians are dead. And they're saying that freedom is being won over there? Those people don't know freedom.
This is what democracy looks like! This is what democracy looks like!
Their voices around the country, starting with Salt Lake City Mayor Rocky Anderson. Tom Andrews, let me ask you straight up, how old are you?
53.
So you've got a kind of vestigial memory of 1969, you would have been barely a teenager when Richard Nixon was in office and 2 million protested coast to coast. I wonder how you see the movement this time, like and unlike Vietnam.
Well, I think Michael was right. I mean, back in those days, you would never imagine being involved in politics, for example, and helping candidates get elected. There was that Crosby, Stills, and Nash song, Don't Get Yourself Elected. If you do, you'll have to cut your hair. I mean, there was a very anti-political mood in the sense of conventional electoral politics. I think one of the big differences here is that people took politics very seriously. They engaged their energy and time and frankly, their money. Tens of millions of dollars was raised among progressives, and untold number of hours were invested in these elections so that a Congress would be elected that would stand up to George Bush. So there's a very, very big difference there. And as a result of that, the expectations for this Congress is extremely high. And back then, of course, people just felt that the system, that is the political system, wasn't working and you might as well not bother. Well, we made the leap that the system could work. We were going to make sure that it was filled with anti-war Democrats that would stand up to the Bush war in Iraq. And if the Congress fails to take action, if it fails to stand up to the president, then I think very much like in Vietnam, people are going to feel that the only alternative they have is to hit the streets and do everything possible to then get the Democrats in Congress to have the backbone to stand up and do the right thing.
Do you think hitting the streets works these days? Does it bring Vietnam back, the memories of it, in a way that's helpful or a burden for you and maybe for Democrats who, and for that matter, Republicans who might oppose the war, but Democrats and anti-war movement got tagged by the right with losing the Vietnam War for many years. Right or wrong, that was the tag laid on them.
You know, I think it's very useful, Tom, to be hitting the streets for several reasons. One, we've got to create a political climate in which members of Congress know just how strongly people feel about this, and they've got to see them, hear them, experience them in every conceivable way. So I think it's very important for us to create this this political climate. But also at the same time, actions that are directed toward Congress. Before the war, for example, we had what we call a virtual march on Washington, and we had over 1 million Americans calling or faxing the U.S. Senate in a single day. So it's not a matter of either or. You have to have a combination of those tactics to focus people's energy and attention on the Congress and get them to act.
Nancy Lesson with Military Families Speak Out. How is your organization seen within the military these days? We saw a poll recently saying 54% of those in uniform now approve of President Bush's handling of the war. That's not a super high percentage of those in uniform, but are you seen as off the reservation or representing a significant point of view within the military?
We get emails from troops in Iraq who are not necessarily our loved ones, who say, thank you for speaking out. You're what's giving us hope that we're going to come home. In fact, we're the largest group of military families who have ever spoken out against a war in the history of this country. And yesterday I was with a group of active duty troops who are filing appeals for redress. There's over 1,000 active duty troops who are filing these appeals for redress with their members of Congress.
It's called
saying,
appeal for redress because it's through the formal kind of military chain of complaint. This is not outside the system. This is right within it, but 1,000 in uniform doing it.
Yes, and saying this war is wrong and bring the troops home. We march in the streets like we're going to do on January 27th with United for Peace and Justice. We'll have a contingent of Iraq war veterans, active duty troops, military families, Gold Star families who lost their loved ones, whose loved ones died as a result of this war, Vietnam veterans, veterans of other eras. So we have quite a powerful military, ex-military, and military family community that I think is a significant trend. But what I also want to say is there's no blueprint that we know of for ending a war. So we have been involved in anything and everything since before the war began. We filed a lawsuit, a group of us, against George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld seeking to prevent a U.S. invasion of Iraq absent a real congressional declaration of war. We've met with members of Congress, and some of us have sat in their offices reading names of those who have died in a war that should never have happened. We speak, we stand in vigils, we march in the streets, and we speak on radio programs, anything and everything right now to, I think, do two things. One is to move this nation from being opposed to the war to taking action to end it. As we've heard, the majority of people in this country are opposed to the war, but many of them are, you know, going about their daily activities, and they need to become active. And we're going to try to use our voices with the real experiences of families and troops about what's really happening in this war to get that action. And then, again, our focus on Congress for them to defund the war, support our troops, and defund the war. At the beginning, I think our voice was very helpful in helping those in Congress and those around the country decouple support for the troops with support for the war. And now we will be raising our voices once again to have them decouple funds for the war and support for the troops.
A lot
Real
of
support for the troops is bringing them home.
A lot of opposition to the war, as you say, but a complex opposition many times as well when you get in and really talk to Americans about what they want, where they think it ought to go. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join us here. Let me begin to turn to them. Mark is calling from North Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I am a member of MoveOn.org and was very actively involved in the anti-war movement at the start of the war. But now I can't lend my support to it because I feel we have a moral obligation. I think American people have forgotten that we overwhelmingly supported the war at its start. We reelected President Bush on that agenda. And now with 67% of the people saying they oppose the war, I really have to question, hey, what about our moral responsibility to the people of Iraq? They elected a democratic government 12 months ago, and we seem to scratch our heads and say, how come you don't have a functioning civil society now? And so for the anti-war movement, I see it as almost a little bit selfish, because now that Americans are paying a heavier price financially and especially in terms of lives, we feel like, oh, we need to pull out. And I feel like, hey, we started the war, and when you start a war, it's serious business, and you have a moral responsibility to the people who are most severely affected by the war, namely the Iraqi people.
Mark, stick with us. And we saw that 34,000 dead, the UN says, Iraqis last year, a huge total, and that many again injured. But Tom Andrews, what about it? Mark articulates a view that I find not uncommon. Mix it up here. What do you say to this American citizen?
Well, it's a very important point to be covering a program like this. And the fact of the matter is, Mark, first of all, we are making things worse with our military presence, not better. The best thing that we can do for Iraq is to begin to bring these troops home and begin that process immediately. And if you have any doubt about it, ask the Iraqi people themselves. 71% of the Iraqi people, Shia and Sunni, believe that the United States military is making things worse in Iraq, not better. And things would get better if we began to pull out. Amazingly, two-thirds of the Iraqi people support attacks on U.S. troops. Their frustration level has gotten to that degree. So if you find yourself in a country in which the vast majority of people hate you and want you out, and the vast majority of the public supports attacks on you, there is no way under any circumstances you are going to be able to prevail. There is no military solution to the situation in Iraq. It's going to have to be political. And the fact of the matter is we are standing in the way of that political resolution. And the sooner we begin the process of getting out and following the will of the vast majority of the Iraqi people, the better chance the Iraqi people are going to have to deal with this crisis, this disaster, and move forward.
Mark, does the logic move you?
No, actually it doesn't, because I mean, part of the logic is we don't know if Iraq would be better. I mean, that's predicting the future. And secondly, I would agree with you on the fact that are the Iraqi people opposed to our military presence, or are they opposed to our current strategy in Iraq? There are certainly ways we can provide support financially through infrastructure, etc., but there's also ways we can provide support with less of an imprint on it. I mean, my look at the situation says we pull out, you're going to have the only military and / police force that's really functioning in Iraq gone, and that's going to open up to a full bloodletting between Shias and Sunnis and Kurds.
Mark, we've got it. There's the voice of hesitance on the pullout, and yet we hear Tom Andrews' argument at the same time. I want to bring another voice into this conversation. Reverend John Thomas joins us. He's General Minister and President of the United Church of Christ, headquartered in Cleveland, Ohio. Describes himself as part of the anti-war movement. He's spoken at big rallies of 100,000 or more. He joins us today from Newton, Massachusetts. Reverend Thomas, thank you very much for being with us.
Tom, I'm delighted to join you today.
How do you see the status and the importance of the anti-war movement this time now in the Iraq War?
I think there's a growing sense of the need for active resistance in addition to what obviously was a very important political initiative around the last election. But I think there's a great need for people on the streets, for members of our churches, to give much more prominent voice to their resistance to this war and to the current strategy, and indeed to the whole response to September 11th, which in my mind has been a very clever manipulation of fear and the creation of a notion of an axis of evil over against which the United States is a unilateral responder. And I think that's done great mischief and raises profound moral questions that the church and many other civil society organizations need to confront.
So is the anti-war movement, to your taste then, feisty enough this time? The streets have certainly not been as crowded, to my eye, as they were in the Vietnam War era. Is that a problem? Do you want to see more out there? Or is the kind of push on the web, the push at the ballot box, the push in the halls of Congress, where you're directing your energies as well, Reverend Thomas?
I think there needs to be a push on the streets and a push at the ballot box and a push in the legislative halls by lobbyists from all kinds of organizations. I don't think it's been feisty enough by any means. I think there was an opportunity when Cindy Sheehan, in a very public and very creative way, began to capture the imagination of the American public. But that's kind of withered away. I've been disappointed, frankly, in my own church and disappointed in other churches that we have not mounted the kind of public voice of resistance that I think is required.
Let me go to Greg in Fort Mill, South Carolina. Hi, Greg, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to give a call to let folks know that not only is there going to be a large national event in Washington, D.C. on September 27th.
September or January?
I'm sorry, January 27th.
That is a week from this weekend, yes.
That's correct. I also wanted to point out that member groups of United for Peace and Justice in small towns all across the country are also going to be sponsoring local events. So people should go to unitedforpeace.org and take a look to see if there's not something going on close to home if they don't feel like they can make it all the way to Washington, D.C.
Greg, do you go out to these events? And when you do, what's the button you're pushing? What's the impact you think you're having?
I hold up a honk for peace sign and everybody honks at me. It lets all of us know that we're not alone. We know that we're not alone. And it's difficult to get outside of our comfort zone and go up to a member of Congress and say, hey, I want you to listen to me, because most of us don't ever have, it's hard to draw yourself to do something that bold. These people are all rich white men. And it's when you empower yourself to take those kinds of moves, it makes it difficult to accept failure. And I'm just afraid the Democratic Party is going to fail us. And so we've got to push hard. I'm a member of the Green Party, and I know a lot of Greens are active in the anti-war movement across the country. So pressure is going to continue to be brought to bear, and hopefully those folks will get it right.
Greg, thanks for your call. Michael Kazin, what do you see here? Enough pressure to move the Democrats and Republican allies on the war from the streets, from this movement, or is it coming simply from the big polls that say Americans don't like the war?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, the opposition is there, but it has to be mobilized. And certainly what Tom and Nancy are doing, and excuse me, the speaker from South Carolina are doing are very important. However, I think that, as I said, in contrast to Vietnam, this is a time when most Americans are opposed to the war because they think it's a waste of life, because they think it's not doing what President Bush and his allies say it's supposed to be doing. So it's not so much that Americans are opposed to the whole thrust of what President Bush calls the anti-terrorist war. They just think this is the wrong place to fight it, and it's not doing what it's supposed to do. But I think that really, of course, everything's being done right now, thinking of 2008. And it's hard to believe that all this pressure is not going to result in some important change by the end of this calendar year.
We'll come back and look at the politics and the protest. Reverend John Thomas, president of the United Church of Christ, thanks very much for being with us this hour. I know we have to let you go, but good luck with your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
The politics here are at the heart of it. On January 3rd, Democratic Congressman Rahm Emanuel of Illinois was starting to address reporters after a meeting of the House Democratic Caucus when he was drowned out by a group of anti-war protesters led by Cindy Sheehan.
Okay, at every stop.
Right.
All right. We're going to keep going here.
Troops home now.
We're going to have
And there it is. Tom Andrews with Win Without War. Give us some political analysis here. There's de-escalate, investigate, troops home now, and Rahm Emanuel asking, what do we do now? Do you think, I mean, as Michael points out, 08 is standing right there. You've got people sort of keeping their powder dry on the war, not wanting to get tagged as those who lost the war, but rather let George Bush carry that flag. Are the Democrats going to stand up for what you and the anti-war movement want?
Well, Tom, that is the very question, and I think that is the focus right now of the anti-war movement and unifying the anti-war movement to make sure that the Congress does the right thing. I want to add that this great march on Washington that's going to happen on the 27th of January, led by United for Peace and Justice, is going to be followed on the following Monday by a lobby day. People are going to be sticking around and meeting with members of Congress and their staff in Washington. And then in the first congressional district work period in February, the first district work period of this Congress, the week of February 19th, there's going to be nationwide meet up with your member week, in which members are going to be visited by citizens who are opposed to this war all over the country. The problem right now, of course, let's talk about this in political terms. Number one, the Democrats entered Congress saying, look, we're going to have this 100-hour agenda. We're going to pass some very important domestic pieces of legislation. We're going to study the war, and then we're going to take some action at some later point. Obviously, events have changed all of that, particularly the president's speech, so they feel that there's a lot more pressure on them to take action. Now the debate is what to do, and the first step that the Democrats are saying that they're going to do is pass a non-binding resolution in the House and Senate expressing the sentiment of members of Congress, force tough votes from Republicans, and show the country and President Bush that the Congress is firmly against them. The danger of that, of course, is that it's non-binding. And there's nothing non-binding about the hell our troops are going through right now in Iraq and the disaster that this policy is. And the political danger is that you could give Republican members of Congress and out. They could vote for a meaningless, non-binding resolution on the one hand, and then when it comes time to actually doing something about it and exercising the power of the purse, they could vote against that for some what they would describe technical reason and say, yeah, but listen, I am on record as opposing this escalation. I did cast that vote on that resolution. So what we as a movement are saying to Congress is don't sit there and talk. Meaningless phrases that add up to nothing is simply not acceptable.
But how do you really get the crowbar under them? Tom, are you saying if you don't vote for cutting off funds, getting out of Iraq, you're going to be in trouble at the ballot box, or you're going to be in trouble in the streets in your hometown?
Well, you're going to be in trouble in both. I mean, that's the point. I mean, this movement is, I think, very focused. It's sophisticated. It understands it's not going to be bamboozled by members of Congress saying, well, we voted for this resolution. People are simply not going to accept it. And they're going to be putting pressure on members in every conceivable way possible at home and certainly at the ballot box if we don't get satisfaction. The president is going to have to ask for more money. And there's a supplemental appropriation coming to Congress. It'll be in the hands of the defense subcommittee on the Appropriations Committee led by Congressman Jack Murtha. That is scheduled to happen on the 5th of February. And when that happens, we're going to be looking first at that subcommittee and then to the Congress as a whole to stop the president's capacity to continue to prosecute this war, including this escalation.
Let's go to Derek in Washington, D.C. Hi, Derek. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Listen, I guess what I would like to say is I don't think that the movement has been radical enough. I think that it has a large component that is anti-George Bush. As much as it's anti-war, it's anti-George Bush because the process, prosecution of the war has made us all feel very scared for the American ideal. And he also seemed to be comfortable letting so many people die in the streets after Katrina. I think much of this movement is because we want new stewardship in this country. And I question how legislators can find themselves to be responsible every day when they allow him to continue in office another day.
So you're saying stand up harder, but the Democrats kind of carried the burden of being weak on national security as a reputation for years after Vietnam. Do they risk that here, Derek, in your view?
I think that they do risk it, but I think the whole system risks showing itself to be about something other than the best for Americans and peace and democracy around the world, and perhaps more about profit interests of corporations.
So there's a tough view, Derek, and we've got it. Thanks for your call. Michael Kazin, how about it? The risks being run here politically as the anti-war movement gains steam and builds the pressure.
We've got two poles here, Tom. On the one hand, if the Democrats only pass a resolution which has no teeth in it, then the war keeps going, and that adds to the frustration. On the other hand, if the anti-war movement becomes too radical, then it can breed a lot of resentment against it, as happened to a degree during the Vietnam War era as well. So what Tom is describing, I think, is sort of a middle road in some senses. Peaceful protest, mass protest, but keeping the pressure on. And the difference with now in the 60s, too, is that there really is not a very large radical movement out there. There are people who certainly have radical critiques of what exists, but I don't see there being a massive movement that really wants a different kind of system, a complete alternative to American capitalism and the kind of foreign policy that comes out of that. And for that reason, I think it's probably safer to continue with the kind of movement that already exists rather than take a leap into the dark.
Nancy Lessen, this goes to your group in a way. We've had voices from many different corners here. I suspect Reverend John Thomas is simply anti-war as a matter of principle. Your group, as I understand it, Military Families Speak Out, doesn't say we're in principle anti-war, but you're against this war. Have we got that right?
We have a very diverse organization of over 3,000 military families who I think span a spectrum from those who consider themselves pacifists who would oppose all war all time to those who have supported or not spoken out against any war in the history of this country until this war in Iraq. And so our principle of unity, what we've come together on, is opposition to the war in Iraq. We have Democrats, Republicans, Independents. We are all over the map on every social issue that you could put before us, but we have come together in a strong and unified way, opposing the war in Iraq and reminding people that each day it goes on, there's loss of life of our loved ones and Iraqi children, women, and men. When we hear about, you know, bringing them home by the end of 2007 or the end of 2008 to satisfy somebody's election strategy, we don't hear it in terms of 365 days in a year. We feel it in terms of, well, that's 800 or more of our loved ones who will never come home. That is countless Iraqi children, women, and men who will perish because of a war that should never have started. So it's unacceptable. Also, I do want to say Congress talks about exit strategy, and we don't see exit as a strategy at all. It's a command. And it's the generals who will know how to redeploy troops out of Iraq. And what they need is that command. We want Congress to use the power of the purse to basically say, make it so. And then it's those generals who will take the troops out as quickly and as safely as possible. And that is not just for the safety of U.S. troops. It is because our presence, the occupation presence in Iraq, is making things worse. It's fuel to the fire, and it's causing more death and destruction in Iraq and among Iraqi people.
Let's hear an order, says Nancy Lesson of Military Families Speak Out. I want to turn for a moment, if I may, to California and Kate Flanagan. She's a senior at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She's a member of Students Against War, which gained some national attention last year for its counter-recruitment efforts. Kate Flanagan, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, how you doing?
We're well. In the Vietnam era, anti-war protest was seen as centered among people your age. Do you feel at the heart of it now?
I think there's a lot of energy coming from students, but definitely not enough right now. There's a lot of passivity among the student population.
Why do you think that is? How do you interpret it? Do they just simply disagree with your view that the U.S. ought to get out of Iraq, or they're not engaged, they're not drafted?
I think a lot of people just don't realize that their actions can have an impact on U.S. policy. So I think what we need to do is empower people and let them know that what they do is important.
Michael Kazin, if there were a draft, would we see a different picture in the streets?
We probably would, but in the 60s, the anti-war protests went way beyond people who were of draft age.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of women were involved who were not being drafted at the time, of course. You know, I think what the student from Santa Cruz is putting a finger on, I feel the same thing at Georgetown, is that this is not a really activist generation in the sense of believing that it's imperative to have an impact on public policy. And part of what happened in the 60s, after all, is the anti-war movement really was the child of the Black Freedom Movement. People forget that the whole repertoire of mass protest, of
civil rights movement,
making politicians live up to their promises, really was came out of the Black Freedom Movement, of the Civil Rights Movement. And the anti-war movement in the late 60s had very much the same spirit that the Civil Rights Movement had, though a different group of people, of course, were the leaders of it. Whereas now you come out of a pretty conservative era, and this is really perhaps the beginning of a newer kind of left, whereas the anti-war movement was the creature of a newer kind of left.
Sort of formed out of the Civil Rights era.
Yeah. And at Georgetown, for example, there's a group of really wonderful people who are protesting the war, but it's kind of a niche activity, if you will. There's probably more people who are young Democrats, young Republicans, who are thinking about their careers in politics than there are people who are thinking about activism being their major goal in life.
Let me get a couple of calls here. Rob in Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Rob. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I think my opinion is that the war was started originally in a deceptive manner, with some questionable intelligence, but now we're in a different situation, and pulling out will result in some more serious long-term global security issues that will have to be dealt with another generation of Americans.
Have you served, Rob?
Yes.
In Iraq?
Yes.
In what capacity?
Intelligence.
So military intelligence in Iraq, when you hear anti-war voices now, including in the military, what's your response? You're saying, no, we can't, but you heard Tom Andrews say, yes, we can, and in fact, we should. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that you have to, I mean, it's a deeply complicated issue. Thousands of years of history, you know, as well as the new American outlook on this, as we approach it from our side of you know, the ocean. And I think American society is enamored with that part of the world, but, you know, the commodity that comes out of it. And there's really no way around oil and dealing with it. And I think one thing that President Bush said in his speech last week, you know, which said that oil in the wrong hands could be worse than, you know, I mean, if you look at it from a different way, than us fighting for oil. Well, maybe we are, but we're fighting so that a rogue state doesn't develop, which has all the money and, you know, deep pockets to do whatever they want with it.
Rob, we hear it, and the deep complications you're pointing to that leave a lot of people thinking clearly and yet coming to different conclusions. Let me get a call from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Nathan, you're on the air.
Thank you. This is a very simple solution, and everyone in the anti-war movement, citizens, legislators should remember, Democrats in particular, should remember that if Bush got us in this, it should be up to the administration to get us out, and we should lay the blueprint to help him since he cannot seem to help himself.
But President Bush isn't talking about getting out. He's talking about surging in, Nathan, as you know.
And that's why we have to help him, because going in will only create more violence, more bloodshed. And the only way to get out is to have the administration go to neighbors in the region and get them involved, because it'll only be through diplomacy and involvement with neighbors.
But it sounds almost like you want to leave it hung around the neck of George Bush as we go toward 08.
That's where it is anyway.
That's where it is. Nathan, thanks for your call. Tom Andrews, we've just got a couple of minutes here. Where do you see this headed? You hear callers talking about the complications of this scene, not cut and dry. Maybe you can leave Vietnam, but here we are in the heart of oil country with a country that may well implode. Does that give you pause, or does that make you, you know, want to put pedal to the metal?
Well, exactly that, pedal to the metal. The fact is the stakes are extremely high, but what we know is that the Bush administration's policy has failed. And what he's decided to do, I mean, the first principle when you find yourself in a hole is to stop digging. And what the president has decided is that the key is to start digging even faster. The Iraq Study Group had it right. You cannot win this thing militarily. You have to have a surge of engagement diplomatically, not militarily. And what the president decided to do and announced last week was not only escalate in terms of the numbers of troops, and of course, the last time we've done that, it caused more violence and more deaths in Baghdad than ever before. It's been tried twice and it failed. But he also announced, not too subtly, an escalation of the war in geographic terms by attacking Iran, saying that Iran is providing material support for our troops, and adding those additional strike groups, battle carriers to the Persian Gulf. This is extremely, extremely dangerous, and we've got to be talking about not only Iraq, but also a widening war in Iran.
January 27th is the next big protest date. I have to recall, it was the anti-war movement before it even began that said don't go. A lot of policymakers right now, I'm sure, wish they had listened. Then, Tom Andrews, National Director of Win Without War, thank you for being with us this hour.
Thank you very much, Tom. And it's winwithoutwarus.org, www.winwithoutwarus.org for more information.
We've got it. Nancy Lesson with Military Families Speak Out. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. And we say it was wrong to invade Iraq, wrong to occupy Iraq, no right way to do a wrong thing. There's an urgency right now.
There it is. Our time is short. Nancy,
MFSO.org.
Got it. Kate Flanagan and Michael Kazin at Georgetown, thanks to you as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.